Hi, today's September 5th, 2015, and this is Mobile News Podcast number 130. I'm Todd Ogasawara with, as usual, or mostly usual, my good friend John Westfall. We've had a couple of weeks where we had some guest panelists.
You know, you do like a year straight, and then you're off for a couple weeks, and I go from usual to mostly usual. It's just the way it goes. You know, the tech industry is ever moving, and
that's right.
If I don't put in my time, I'm just going to be replaced by other former MVPs.
Well, you know, let me tell you, when my daughter was little, I told her, you know, you're my third favorite child. And she looks at me, she's about 3 or 4 years, I'm your only child. I said, yes, but everyone needs to aspire to be better than they are.
And that is why Asian children are so well adjusted when it comes to work-life balance.
But at any rate, she moved up to be my first favorite child, so that was good.
Very good. I'm glad that you promoted her so that she didn't live her whole life striving for your favorite spot.
That's right. Okie dokie. So we are at September 5th as we record this podcast, and we're, 4 days away from whatever it is Apple's going to announce. We're pretty sure they're going to announce a new iPhone, so we're not going to go over that. Or we could. There's a couple of things interesting about that.
Yeah, the camera upgrades are really the only thing notable, and you know whatever they're going to do with Force Touch, that seems kind of interesting, but it'll be seen what they end up doing with it. It looks like a very logical evolutionary release, just like all of Apple's releases are. You know, I think I'll be very happy next year when I get my iPhone 7 Plus to see what features get included with it, but I don't see it enough for me to upgrade from the 6 Plus to the 6S Plus right now.
Yeah, same here. And, you know, I bought, I'm on AT&T for my iPhone, and so I guess I have the last of the subsidized iPhones. Cause didn't AT&T drop subsidies like everybody, like T-Mobile and other places?
Yeah, I guess, but I have no idea how all this is going to play out. I'm on the last, I guess, generation of contracts with Verizon, so we shall see, because I still had a subsidized iPhone when I bought mine.
Yeah, you know, and I don't understand it, because if they're not going to lower the monthly rate, you know, and not give me a subsidy, I'm not sure how this works exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't work that well for us. It's it was much better in the past when, you know, I went to upgrade my phone and my wife's phone, and we could only pay $500. Now, if we wanted to do that sort of double upgrade in the future without any sort of subsidy, that's going to be quite a chunk of change.
Yeah, it might be close to $2,000, but
yes.
In any case, there are a couple of things that we are expecting them to announce, and the thing that I've been waiting for a long time is the iPad Pro. The long rumored but never verified, at least to my satisfaction, 12-inch or so iPad. So what do you think?
I am also waiting for it. There has been a lot of back and forth among the rumor mill about if we're going to see this at this announcement or if Apple will make an iPad-only announcement next month like they did last year. There's also this iPad Mini 4 that is being rumored. So it would not surprise me if Apple decides not to talk about iPads until next month. I think if we do see the iPad Pro this next week, it's going to be in a signature, but wait one more thing sort of reveal at the end. And they'll tease it much the way they teased the Apple Watch last year, and then it didn't come out. I don't see the iPad Pro availability until at the earliest November.
Now, you know, one of the other things I've read in the various rumor sites, and in particular, I think, I have it up on my 9to5 Mac, is that there's going, not there, but Apple is going to, for the first time, come out with a keyboard, their own branded keyboard for the iPad Pro. So, you know, my problem at that point is, okay, so let's say they charge their usual $100 or so for a keyboard, because everybody else charges about $50, so Apple will be $100.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say the iPad Pro for 64 gigs is, I don't know, $700, right?
You're being generous. I was going to say $799.
Okay, let's go $800. So we're talking $900 for an iPad, a 12-inch iPad Pro, and a keyboard. I'm just kind of talking, trying to figure out for myself what to do here. Might make more sense for me to buy another MacBook Air at that point.
Yeah, it definitely might. But it's all about your usage scenarios, I would assume.
Yeah.
If it's going to be a heavy lifter for you, then I would say go with the iPad. If that's if you're basically not creating content but replying to content or working with content, the same distinction that we've always had between Mac and iOS seems to be prescient here too. So if you are doing a lot of traveling where you're in and out of coffee shops and you need to just be able to sit down, reply to emails, write a few things up, etc., then sure, get the iPad for that. If you're like me, I'm probably looking to get one so that when I give lectures, I have a bigger screen so I can see more of my notes and things like that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense for you.
But for, I would not think of this in any way as taking the place of a laptop.
And that's my problem, you know, as it gets more and more expensive, regardless of its mission in life, so to speak. You got to start thinking, you know, when it's $1,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
Essentially.
It's definitely, just like, I think of it this way. The first iPad I got, it took me a good year to figure out how an iPad fit into my life.
Mm-hmm.
And once I've gotten it in there, I'm very happy with the use scenarios I have for my iPads. Like I've said in the past, I have a iPad mini that I use for content consumption, so things like articles and videos and YouTube and all of that goes on that. And then I've got a full-size iPad that goes for anytime I'm reading things for work or I'm giving a lecture. It's what I control Keynote through. And so for me, I could see the iPad Pro becoming more of the work iPad, and then my current iPad Air would become more of a reading for work iPad. Mm. So if you can fit it in and see a good use scenario, then I think it's practical. But if you don't have a use scenario, it's a lot of money to pay just for another toy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my problem right now. And the other problem I have, you know, because I like Windows 10 so much, is I have been carrying an Asus tablet with a keyboard, which is, you know, very much like an iPad Pro with a keyboard. It's a 10-inch device, not a 12, but still. But you know what? It only costs $350.
Yes. Yeah, those Windows 10 devices are getting more and more competitive with to the Apple devices. Yeah. Honestly, if I wasn't so heavily invested in the Apple ecosystem in terms of everything I do, it would be very tempting to jump back to Windows right now.
And I would add that, you know, because it has a micro SD slot, it has 128 gigabytes of storage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for whatever I paid, me, let's say $35 or $40, whatever I paid for a 64 gig micro SD card or so, you know, it's for under $400, including the SD card, and that includes the keyboard. It came with a keyboard, a physically attached keyboard, by the way, not Bluetooth. It's an awfully good deal, and I can do, you know, if we're talking about work, you know, using Microsoft Office and you know, having Chrome with all the add-ons and things, I've got that. And iPad actually isn't going to do that. So, yeah, like the Apple Watch, where I got all excited about it and said, whoa, it's really expensive. I'm not sure I need one. And, you know.
And you got a Moto 360 instead.
Yeah. And so this time around, it might be something similar where, you know, I spent the last, I don't know, however long the rumor's been around, a year, getting all excited about iPad Pro, and now I may just say, I'm already carrying a nice Windows 10 tablet that can do a lot of work things that the iPad can never do. For example, I can run, you know, open source software like R Project for statistics on it that I can't do on iPad. You know, mm-hmm. I can install compilers and languages, and I wouldn't be a really fast development machine, but, you know, if you really want to do it, there it is. Or even lightweight stuff. You know, I can put on awk and grep and stuff for Windows on there if I need to do things like that. So I may end up with whatever new iPad mini is.
You know, Todd, you can always create an RStudio server.
That's true.
Run that in the browser.
That is true.
I actually did that this week on one of my virtual machines that are virtual private servers that I pay, I think, $10 a month from a, you know, low-end hoster. And, it works fine for what I needed to do with.
And that is a good point. And I do have a low-end – actually, I have two for a lot of reasons. I have two web hosts I use that, you know, I have a shell access to and I can install stuff. So I don't know if I can install our project server on there. I don't know if they'll let me – does that, like, go through HTTP or does it need its own port?
It goes through HTTP. Actually, you can run it on any port. By default, 8787, but you can throw it on 80 if you want.
Okay. Anywho, so I'm looking forward to that, and I would like something with Force Touch because that's the other rumored, you know, enhancement to whatever the new all the new devices actually, iPhones, iPad, that sort of thing. So looking for that, and also I don't have anything to run split screen, so I need something new, just to play with split screen.
You need new toys.
I just don't know what.
What and I the other afford. Thing that we are pretty sure will show up is the next gen Apple TV.
So oh,
I think
yeah.
that's a very safe assumption that will show up at the announcement. The iPad Pro, we'll have to see.
Yeah, and you know, I would be more excited about the new rumored Apple TV, which is supposed to have the ability to install and use iOS apps and some kind of Siri interface on it, except that it still can't play Amazon Prime videos, and that's kind of important in my house. So that's a little bit of problem. That's the only bottleneck for me to go shell out another, again, rumored, we don't know for sure, somewhere between $150 and $200, according to rumors.
Of course, if it can install certain iOS apps, maybe it can install the Amazon Instant Video app.
We shall see. And if it does, and that solves, you know, it's problem solved at that point.
Yeah. And for me, when I stream Amazon Instant Video, I just stream it from my iPad Mini and AirPlay it over to the Apple TV, and it works fine.
That's a good
point.
But
then I need to have a charger next to my couch for the iPad so it doesn't lose battery.
Right now, in the middle of the movie.
Streaming things for 3 or 4 hours, and it's, you know, even with the screen off, it's still chugging through battery to do that.
Yeah. So, and you know, we don't have this in the show notes, but the tagline for this upcoming Apple event is, what is it? Give me a hint, Siri, or something like that?
Siri, give me a hint.
Yeah, so why is Siri featured, do you think?
I think because Siri will show up on the Apple TV. Siri obviously is on every other product. What I would love on my wish list of things would be if Siri would show up on macOS.
Now that would be something, wouldn't it?
Because with Cortana on Windows 10 now, it would be really cool. No one's predicting it. No one is saying it will ever happen. But it would be really cool if Apple just brought Siri to macOS as well.
Yeah, by the
way, Siri is now on every Apple product.
Yeah, by the way, Cortana is now available on Android. It's not very good yet, but it's there. So, you know, it's cross-platform now.
Until Cortana actually behaves like she does in the Halo series, I'm not going to, you know, until she could actually give me directions to, you know, the different positions I should take against the incoming wave of bad guys, you know, all that stuff. I need Cortana to give me, like, offensive driving tips when I'm driving, like, cut off that guy, cut through that yard, you know, that sort of deal.
All right. Yeah, it would be pretty cool if Siri were a tactical expert.
I would just, Cortana, you know, I should say. It'd be great if Cortana or Siri or anyone, you know, could basically fully utilize the Skynet skills, the Skynet that you claim Google is building.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there's some gag sites where they have Siri and Cortana talking to each other. That's, you know, that would actually be pretty interesting. And, you know, why not bring the Amazon Echo into and have everybody talk to each other?
Yeah.
I guess Google Now really doesn't speak as much as Siri or Cortana, but it's...
We have to remember, though, for those of us that have MacBooks, there is the say command in the shell where we can make Siri say anything we want. The Siri's voice in macOS is named Samantha, so you can have for a while... I actually had Siri giving announcements out before my college classes. Siri would remind the students about upcoming things and everything else, and Siri could say whatever I wanted Siri to say. So.
Hey, you in the back, wake up.
Yeah, exactly. I've actually thought about, that's another wish list app of mine, would be a customizable soundboard app, but that has remote capability, but alas, that's nothing I've seen yet unless I build it.
Alas, indeed. And, you know, speaking of Google Now, so, you know, my long, drawn-out and sad saga of getting a Google Fi invitation and having not to execute it and waiting months and months and months for a second one. Well, the second one finally came to me a couple of weeks ago. I finally executed it, got my Nexus 6 in this past week, have been enjoying using it, but I'm using it with an alternate account because I could not, I did not want to destroy my Google Voice number, which would be the, and all the archives if, you know, if I use my main account and I verified it again with Fi tech support. But it's been kind of interesting, so I don't have Google Voice on it. I think I actually could slide it on, so I'm thinking about trying something. I have used a Google Takeout to archive all my data, you know, offline. If something really, really bad happens, I'll still be able to go back through my messages and things from, I don't know how long I've had this now. It's a couple of years at least. I don't know how long, maybe seven
probably,
years?
Probably as long as I've had Google Voice, and that was 2009, I think, was when...
When it was Grand Central, before Google bought it.
Before Grand Central and became Google Voice. Yeah, because my number was a Grand Central number.
Yeah, me too. So it's at least, what, 6, 7, 8 years old now.
I'm trying to remember. I know I set up Grand Central in 2007 or so, maybe? 2008?
That sounds about right.
Because I remember exactly where I was when I set it up, so I can place myself in the right house at least.
Well, that's scary.
Yes. I remember thinking to myself, well, this is a number I'm never going to use, but this sounds like a cool service. But I'll try to sign up for something that's easy to remember anyway. And so that's why I have a number that I'm quite happy with Google Voice.
So what I did is I set up a second account, as folks who've listened to this podcast know, and that's attached to my... But I did. It turns out that if you install the Gmail app, you don't have to install it. It comes with it installed. And you add the second account, which in this case is my primary account, a lot of things start flowing over, including notifications of email from, both the primary and the secondary account. Things seem to be flowing into Google now, it knows where I'm going to drive next, which kind of surprised me. The only thing I don't get is our actual Google Voice notifications, because I don't have Voice installed on here. But I do get Gmail notifications, because Google Voice sends a notification to Gmail. So at least I know when I have something Google Voice. And ironically, I have to use an iPhone to go check it.
Well, you could install Google Voice on the Nexus and sign it in with your old account.
I'm pretty sure I can. And I'm trying to figure out what I want to do next. Like I said, I did do that. And what the Google Fi tech support suggests I do is create a third Gmail account, use Google Takeout to take out my archive, move my Google Voice account to the third Gmail account. I would lose the archive, by the way. I would only have the offline archive. I wouldn't have an online archive anymore, but I would keep the number. Mm-hmm. And then they would. I would need their help, but it's possible for them to move my primary account over to this Google Fi account, so basically, my original Gmail account. And all of that really is the main thing is I want to get my Google Play attached, because right now I don't have my watch faces that I purchased anymore.
Oh yes, well, actually, you definitely want to get that.
My $1.99 watch face, the last of the big time spenders. Or books and movies. So none of that's available on this, I think. Although, I have to play with it, because it does handle multiple accounts, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. Anyway.
I've been using multiple Gmail accounts. I've got several Gmail accounts for different organizations and this and that. And when Google was sunsetting Google apps for free, back when you could get 50 free users, I signed up a bunch of my domains with that. So I've got probably 4 or 5 different Google apps installations. I used a primary gmail.com address for a number of years, and then I went to a Google Apps address. So I'm quite adept at making multiple Google accounts work together, and they usually do. You can usually get them to play nice, so I think you'll be able to do that with just a little bit of work.
So despite not having gone through all those account gymnastics yet, it's still been a useful device to me. Google Now is not quite as useful as it might be. I have a couple of trips coming up, one-day flights, so we'll see if it alerts me to my flights and all of that like it normally does. We'll see. But all in all, so far, so good. I can't say... I will say this is kind of fun, odd. So my Nexus 4, which is the phone I replaced, was not an LTE phone. It was HSPA Plus on T-Mobile. The Nexus 6 is an LTE phone, which uses both T-Mobile and Sprint.
Mm-hmm.
So far, my tests indicate it's 4G, let's call it. Its LTE is slower than HSPA Plus, even though it should be on the same network.
That doesn't surprise me, I think, as much as it should, just because we have to remember that 4G is such a fragmented term in terms of what it actually means, that there are very few, not all 4Gs are created equal, and not all better than 4Gs are created equal. So. Yeah.
I will say one good thing about the Nexus 6 compared to my Nexus 4. My Nexus 4 is battery, which is now... how old is it now? I think it's 2.5 years old. My Nexus 4's battery was not lasting really even half a day with very little use. And after getting my Nexus 6, I basically turned in, you know, did some testing on my Nexus 4. I left it in airplane mode, and I just charge it up at night, unplug it, you know, before I go to sleep, and let it roll. And it's practically dead by the time I get back home, having done absolutely nothing, including no Wi-Fi connections. So it's just sitting there, mm-hmm. you know, probably waking up, you know, some kind of cron waking up to try to go talk to the network, but nothing's there. So that battery was about to go. So it was time to replace it regardless. Any rate, so that's, I will report on my Google Fi and Nexus 6 adventures as I try to get my accounts all straightened out.
I look forward to hearing about them as we continue on. It's interesting to me how we have our relative adventures and the different things that we use. Yeah. My adventure this week was getting my first non-Apple band for my Apple Watch setup, but that wasn't all that adventurous because it was a $7 adapter I bought on eBay.
Yeah, it does sound kind of painful though to put on and everything.
Yeah. Well, for those that didn't see or don't know me on social media, I had a picture of this. It's basically a survival strap band, a paracord band, but it has a metal shackle connector. So basically a U shape with the metal that goes in the middle and then a pin that goes in. So if you can imagine putting that on your wrist, holding, trying to get the little piece of metal to stay at exactly the right spot and get the pin in, it takes about 30 seconds if you're lucky to do it.
Yeah, if you make it tight, you could use it like a torture device. Talk!
You could just keep doing it. I will say that there was a very nice band that a seller on eBay was selling.
Yeah, it did look good.
The problem was the metal looked much nicer than the plastic snap, but the plastic snap would have been much easier to put on.
Yeah, and you know, given the material, it looks like something that's really good for warm weather kind of situations, because it looks like it lets your, you know, skin breathe through the material.
Yep.
Because, you know, it's not solid covering your skin.
The miracles of paracord.
Yeah. Okay, speaking of miracles, so, you know, and this has been an odd one, if you are an iOS user and you want to watch Amazon Prime, there was no problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you were an Android user and you wanted to watch Amazon Prime videos, it was a problem because there was no app to watch it. But this past week, Amazon solved a whole bunch of things in one fell swoop. So not only did they release an Amazon Prime Instant Video viewing app for Android, they also became the first streaming video service that I know of that lets you download and watch videos offline, unlike Netflix and Hulu.
That is a nice feature for travel for a number of reasons.
Yeah, so if you have an iOS or Android device, you can and an Amazon Prime account, you know, the free 2-day shipping thing. It's not every single movie and TV show, but the ones that are featured on their homepage on Amazon Prime Instant Video, I sampled a few, you know, 5 or 6, not a lot, but all of them had downloads available. Both episodic television, you know, like Warehouse 13, for example, an old sci-fi show that I really enjoyed, as well as movies, and not just English movies, also foreign movies. So I downloaded a foreign movie as a test case. You can choose either HD or SD. I chose SD because, you know, I'm looking on a phone where, you know, HD I didn't think would make that much difference, except in killing my storage space. So I downloaded I think it's like a 100-minute long movie. In standard def, it was about 600 and somewhat megabytes. So on a 32 gig Nexus 6, it wasn't, you know, didn't take too much of a hit. And it's pretty good, you know, lets me watch it. This particular movie, and I think licenses differ per, you know, per whatever it is you're watching, but it gave me a very odd 76 days of offline viewing. Not sure why it's 76, but I'm not complaining. And, you know, that's really important because if you're taking a week or two off to either go on a business trip to somewhere, you know, out of country where you don't have streaming available, because, as you know, if you have I don't know about Amazon Prime, if you have a Netflix account in the U.S., it doesn't work in Europe, for example. So, you know, you can download a bunch of videos to, you know, take with you on a plane trip or whatever and watch it offline. And 76 days is a lot for travel. But even if it's 7 or 14 days, that's fine for most of us. And the clock doesn't start ticking until you actually start viewing.
Well, it just reminds me of the old game shows in the 70s that used to give away 2-month cruises.
Yeah.
You know, and you watch it now and you go, who had time to take a 2-month cruise? Well, if you find yourself on a 2 or 3 month cruise, Amazon's got you covered.
Right. And as far as I can tell, you know, I haven't really tested it, but if you connect back to the internet, that shot clock stops ticking.
Interesting.
Basically, 76 days off, literally offline. Like, I don't connect to the internet, or at least from a country that I can connect back to you.
Amazon is doing interesting things. I just would like to know the licensing people that were arguing. My guess is that it was an argument between 75 and 90, and this 90 guy finally got the 75 guy to budge, and the budge was one more day.
Yeah, well, you know, I just, like I said, I suspect it differs from company to company with the movie, but this one happened to be a South Korean movie. So if you look at the normal rentals they have, I think their rentals are only like 24 hours once you start viewing it. But you have 7 to 15 days to actually, you know, start the clock ticking. So I expect most of them will be in the, you know, 15 to 30 day range, which I think, like I said, I think is fine. If it's 76 days, that's fine. And again, if you can reconnect to your, you know, to the internet, apparently it stops ticking. So, you know, if you're on a 5-hour flight, you know, that's way less than 76 hours, according to my little math. So, yes. I mean, 76 days, I'm sorry.
Yes.
So 76 days. So you should be fine. Anyway, looking forward to playing this more. And quite frankly, I haven't really watched much Amazon Prime Instant Video, even though it's, you know, part of my package. I don't have to pay anything extra. But this has piqued my interest and makes it a lot more useful to me. Also, Netflix chose not to re-sign with Epix. So they lost a whole bunch of recent movies like Hunger Games and I think Avengers. But if you have Amazon Prime, you still got it because Amazon did re-sign with Epix. For those,
and this last summer, my Amazon Instant Prime, the video that I was very happy to find was a British series called Catastrophe. It was a 6-episode. They've been advertising it heavily, but it's quite worth the 3-hour time investment to watch the 6 half-hour episodes.
I might take a look at that. I have seen all the you know, the ads they've been pushing in various places, so.
It was worth it. Especially, I mean, the ads give you a good indication of the storyline, and with really 6 half-hour episodes, you can go through it in a night and get a nice little story and be anxious to see where it goes when Series 2 comes out in, I guess it's next year it's going to be, so.
Yeah. And just to, I guess it's a British show? Is that what it is?
Yeah, so that's the only problem. Yeah. These are done in, you know, these short series instead of seasons as we would think of them. But
yeah, so the Brits call their season series. So Doctor Who fans, for example, will know that we are getting ready for, what is it, Series 9? And I think we're going to Series 9. Yeah, Series 9.
Yeah, and it's basically because the British model never assumes there's going to be another series. It's, you know, it could be... Yeah. One and done, two and done, something like that.
Well, so. And they skip years sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah, they'll, like, you know, take a break. You know, there was a time when there was, like, a weird 4-episode Doctor Who season. And a lot of us are really angry, but at any rate, that's what it was. I think Torchwood was the same thing. There was a 5-episode season that a lot of us were angry about. But we're just angry people, what can I say?
Yeah, I can understand that.
Now, speaking about angry people, now I don't think Steve Gibson's angry, but Steve Gibson, as many of you may have heard on Leo Laporte's Twit Network and Security Now and other places, is really takes deep dives into security and malware and adware and all that. And one of the things he mentioned in the recent Security Now podcast really caught my attention. And it's this piece of free add-on for Firefox or Chrome called uBlock Origin. That's uBlock. That's literally spelled UBLOCK Origin, which is a fork of a project called uBlock. And what it does is a lightweight ad blocker. Now, you know, I have to say I have mixed feelings about ad blockers because I have worked for very many places, and I currently do some freelance writing for ExtremeTech.com. You know, that depends on website ads to pay me, essentially. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't like it when people block ads personally, just it affects me sometimes. But, you know, but on the other hand, there are some sites that have gone way, way, way overboard with ads and pretty close to malware. In fact, sometimes they are serving up malware.
Well, and it usually comes through a hijack of the ad network.
Exactly.
So an owner of a website that doesn't keep an eye on their ads, and I've actually known website owners that browse their own websites with ad blockers in place because they don't want to see their own ads, which I find extremely ironic. But if you don't pay attention, that's where a lot of malware is slipping through now. Hackers know if they can get into the syndication networks for the ad networks. You can just throw stuff in there, and even if it's caught after a half hour, you've probably gotten quite a number of new infections off of that.
Yeah. So, well, you know, I respect Steve Gibson's opinions. So, you know, I've never really looked at these ad blockers, you know, for the stated reasons. But I said, well, if Steve Gibson thinks this is good, I should at least take a look at it and see what he's talking about. And quite frankly, it's amazing. sites that were unbelievably slow, we're talking about you, Verge, are all of a sudden very sprightly when you read them. Now, I'm not quite sure. You can turn it off on certain sites, so please turn it off at extremetech.com so you can see the ads, and I get paid. But, you know, there are some sites, and you know who you are, bad sites. I'm Verge, I'm just kidding you, but you are kind of heavy. So is Extreme Tech, I guess. But, you know, all the tech sites are kind of heavy because they need to get money to pay us. But, you know, there are some sites that are really, really heavy and mostly entertainment sites. And if you like, and I like to read entertainment sites, I'll be very honest. You know, talk about movies and comic books and things like that. And sometimes it just gets so oppressive. I can't even, you know, click on the scroll down because there's so many blinky, blanky things or videos auto-playing and all of that. And this seems to take care of a lot of them, if not all of them, in a very, very nice way. So go take a look at it. Please don't block me because, you know, I need to get paid for my little tech articles. But go take a look at them. And you can adjust it to your heart's content, by the way. So you can say how much of it you want to block, what kind of things you want to block. And it also does automatically block ad banners that may go to a you know, a malware site. So it's smart enough to detect that. Take a look at uBlock Origin. It was pretty interesting.
Is it Origin or Origin?
Origin. O-R-I-G-I-N.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like Stewie from Family Guy, you were pronouncing the emphasis on a very strange part there. So I was just checking to cool find out how I should cool get.
All right.
Now and the ruined evening, yes.
Now, you got something you've bought.
Yeah, so as I joked with you beforehand, I was buying $20 of things on Amazon the other day and thought, what could I do to make this $90 instead of $20? One of the things I had my eye on for a while, I'm a big kind of stylus aficionado. I like using different styluses, but I've never found a really good stylus for iOS or for capacitive touch in general. We had some really nice styli for resistive touch back in the day because basically you could have a really fine little point and it would pick up. So Adonit, which is a well-known stylus manufacturer, about 3 years ago came out with something called the JotScript Evernote Edition. And it was a stylus optimized for apps that integrated with Evernote. So Penultimate was the primary integration point. Mm-hmm. It also works for Goodreads and what I use, a product called Note Shelf. So I thought I'd buy it a few years ago. I bought it. I was pretty disappointed with it. Came to find out that maybe I had a defective one, so I sent it back last year. Yeah, nice enough to send me a new one. The new one worked much better, but still was sort of laggy in the sense I couldn't move as fast as I wanted to. And what we really want with a good stylus is the ability to fluidly write without having to slow down for the stylus. Right. So I bought the JotScript 2, the new version, and played around with it yesterday for the first time and was blown away. I could write with fluid motion the way I normally would if I was writing on a piece of paper. So I am really happy with the way Adonit has stepped up their game with this new edition. I'm a little sad that the first edition didn't have all of this, but the new edition is also thinner and it has a rechargeable battery and comes with a little USB charger for it. So
And how much again was this? Was this like $70 you
said? It was $74.
$74.
It also, though, comes with 6 months of Evernote Premium.
Oh, that's actually so valuable.
Yeah, if you're an Evernote Premium customer already, this can extend your time by another 6 months.
Yeah.
So you figure right there, that's about a $25 value.
Yeah, yeah, because I think it's, what, $49 a year for Premium. Actually, Evernote has two levels, or three levels now. They have free, premium, and something in between. But premium is probably what a heavy Evernote user really wants.
Yeah, so that's why I thought it was a no-brainer to kind of play with it. And if you haven't ever played around with Note Shelf, it's all one word.
No.
I really like Note Shelf on iOS just because the I don't really like Penultimate's new view where it doesn't look like a notebook anymore. I kind of want something that looks like a notebook. So Note Shelf has been a nice app for a while, and the killer feature for me with Note Shelf is the little magnification window where the bottom is basically magnified 4 or 5 times, and so as you write in very large pen strokes, the actual text that you're writing at the top of the note is much smaller. So it's a quick way to take notes without having huge printing all over your note pages.
Yeah, two things. You know, one, I also had a problem with the Penultimate when I tried to use it again. And I had not been using it, but I was at a conference. And I thought, I'll give it a try, and I didn't like it. So I went to Notability, which I do like. It worked out really well for conference notes because I could easily integrate photos and things right in, you know, in line with my typed notes as it was. Wasn't carrying a pen and my finger. I don't know if you can do handwriting in Notability, but anyway, I didn't really wasn't interested in it. Also, I was using a Mac iPad Mini rather, and I think when I wrote, you know, with basically a fat finger on a small tablet, it's really hard to see. But have you tried either the original Jot or the current one on iPad Mini versus a regular size iPad?
I have not tried them. I tried the original Jot on the iPad Mini, and I tried the original Jot on my iPhone.
Yeah,
the original Jot actually worked better on the iPhone than it worked on any of the iPads. And it's interesting you talk about Notability. Earlier this week, I was meeting with someone. And I knew I was going to want to jot down some notes, and I thought, you know what? I just want a nice handwriting app that I can note in. And I downloaded Notability because I had it for free. I must have gotten it somewhere years ago on a freebie, and it. It does handwriting on iPhone.
Oh, very good.
Basically turned my iPhone into a little notepad, which is exactly what I wanted.
Yeah, I'm really impressed by Notability. There are a few things I wish it would do, but it wasn't important enough for me to not use it, if you know what I mean.
And here's a cool feature of the new Jot script. It automatically turns off when you close the app that it's connected to.
Oh, so really?
If you turn off your iPad or go to another app where you're not going to use the pen, it automatically turns off, which is great if you don't want to have to bother turning it off. It's kind of annoying if you wanted to use it to pen around your interface, but it's a cool feature. I just haven't figured out if there's a way to turn it on and off, the auto-off feature.
Yeah, it actually sounds very useful, you know, because most people probably forget to turn it off and the battery dies.
Yes, and since the original Jot script used a quadruple A battery, which are not exactly the easiest to find. I mean, they are sold in, you know, Walmart and other stores, but still, not the easiest to find. So if you ran that battery out, you were kind of annoyed.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I was just thinking that there's a use case where a larger iPad Pro would make a lot of sense, because I would think it'd be a lot easier to use handwriting on a larger surface versus, you know, something like an iPhone or iPad Mini. Has there been any talk about Apple coming up with a stylus for the iPad Pro?
There is. It's supposedly going to have a stylus.
See, Steve Jobs is probably like spinning around at, you know, 10,000 RPM.
Would want to kill someone over that one. But.
Yeah, because, you know, he famously said that, you know, styluses are, you know, not the way to use it. That's why we're going to use the finger.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably going to give a certain finger to some people at Apple. If they
introduce a stylus. Very soon.
But, you know, you got to admit, you know, or I should note, not you got to admit, but I should note that one of the most popular accessories for the iPad has been stylus, for like the one you just bought, like the Donut Jot script.
It's what people want. So, sorry, Steve, we don't agree that our fingers are always the best styluses.
Yeah.
They are really great for penning, for moving around the operating system.
Yeah. Or for finger painting.
They're not so great for writing.
Yeah, you know, for finger painting, fingers are great. They're not. I've tried to handwrite with my finger, and it's just not a natural kind of thing. And, the kind of passive capacitive pens that, you know, basically pretend they're a finger, they don't work so well.
I mean, maybe the kids today can do it, but I am used to writing in cursive, and which it amazes me that I can even read my own cursive writing, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah. All right. You got anything else to add, John?
I have one quick thing that was a wow, that's cool sort of thing that I took for granted until I needed it this week. If you are completely invested in the Apple ecosystem like I am, you know, I guess I could be called a fanboy if I thought Apple was always better, but I don't think they're always better. It just happens to be the platform I'm on. But I do use Safari as my primary browser, and I realized, I guess a couple of months ago, but it was really useful this week, that Safari on all of my iOS devices and on my MacBooks mm-hmm. all sync up to a common iCloud history.
Hmm.
So this means that when earlier this week, I thought, well, what was I looking at last Thursday? And I can pull up Thursday's history, and it's got every page on any device I looked at. So it's very useful, especially if you don't remember where you were at or you forgot to bookmark something.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a really cool feature that Apple never talks about, the shared history in Safari.
Okay, and I'll add to that with something I've been using for a while, and that is if you are a Google Chrome user, and as you know, I've removed Google Chrome from a lot of my older device, including this MacBook Air we're recording this on right now. But if you are a Google Chrome user, and I honestly do use Google Chrome on a lot of different devices and desktops, if you log into Google Chrome, you know, and you probably did, you know, if you want to use it for email and things like that, it too will remember its history across all devices and platforms. So whether you're in an Android phone, tablet, iPad, iPhone, desktop, you know, Mac OS X, Windows, whatever, you can go back through its history and look by device. So you say, oh, I remember looking at this on my iPhone. Mm-hmm. You can actually check just the iPhone history.
Very cool.
Yeah. So there you go, Google Chrome. And something else I'm going to be writing about this weekend for ExtremeTech.com is a new Google Docs feature that was launched last week that lets you do speech to text, you know, kind of the holy grail. I mean, in the old days, as I'm going to say in my article, is 20 years ago, if you said, I want to dictate to my computer, go, well, you're going to have to spend a couple $100 in software. You're going to need a special microphone that's, you know, pretty good. And you're going to have to teach the software how you speak and pronounce things, otherwise it really won't know what you're saying most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
With the cloud, of course, Google can now do this all in the cloud, and you know, I still have to do more testing, but I'll be writing about that. And if you have an Android device, don't know if it works on iPhone. Don't think it works on iPhone yet. If you have an Android device or on a desktop, either Windows or Mac OS X, you can go ahead and try it now. You can dictate your heart away, and if you've ever hurt your finger or arm or something, this could be potentially useful to you someday when that terrible thing happens. Anyway, Google Docs, speech to text.
Very good.
All right. Now, we'll talk about that more in our next podcast. All righty. So, this has been MobileViews Podcast number 130 with John Westfall and